Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Daniel Brook, whose new book is The Accident of Color, a story of race and reconstruction. We'll also hear from Kelly Harris, who has a new job as outreach coordinator for New Orleans for Poets and Writers, Inc. Daniel Brook is a New Orleans writer and journalist. You may have seen his work in Harper's, the New York Times Magazine, or The Nation, or read his last book, A History of Future Cities, of which New Orleans was one, or his first book, The Trap, Selling Out to Stay Afloat in Winner Take All America. Today, we're talking about his new book, The Accident of Color, A Story of Race and Reconstruction. Well, Daniel Brook, welcome back to The Reading Life.
So great to be back. Thank you for having me.
What a story. I mean, but instead of future cities this time, you've created what's really a tale of two cities, New Orleans and Charleston, and for a very particular reason. And you make some real connections between those two cities. And I love the way you call them the misfit metropolises. So talk a little bit about that.
Sure. Yeah. I just got my first hard copy of the book yesterday via UPS overnight. The first quote about the last book that appears on the back is, "An inspired and invigorating survey of the future by way of the past." That's supposed right. to be praise for A History of Future Cities, but I think in many ways, I would hope it could equally apply to The Accident of Color. Mm-hmm. The Accident of Color is a history book. It is about New Orleans and Charleston in the period immediately preceding the Civil War till the rise of Jim Crow around, let's say, 1890 is when the Separate Railcar Act segregating the railcars is passed in Louisiana. So it's that period. But at the same time, it's an introduction to these misfit metropolises filled with immigrants, people speaking different languages on the street, people coupled in all kinds of different ways, people from different continents meeting and having children together. And in many ways, if you squint, you could see a place like Miami or Houston mm-hmm. today, a cosmopolitan immigrant stew. In a way, you can still see this in New Orleans, but it's kind of the stew is settled a bit. It's like the yes. second day soup where it all tastes like it's been blended together instead of where you still have all of the individual ingredients.
So how did you come to this story? This is a bit different for you, isn't it?
To me, in my mind, it's not as big of a departure. I've always been interested in the cosmopolitan and political possibilities of the city. I've always been interested in how the past influences the future and how the past in some ways can echo the future. And my last book ended, literally the last pages of my last book were about this distinction between Europeans and Asians and how that was created. I mean, any child looking at a map of the world can see that Asia and Europe are the same piece of land. Mm-hmm. There's no continental divide between them. The divide is entirely mental. And it goes back to the ancient Greeks who decided that they were superior to the barbarians across the water in what's now Turkey. And they said, well, it's because we're European and it's because they're Asian. And that's why they're different. And that's why they're barbarians. Geographers kept assuming they were going to find this important divider. And then when they didn't, they just decided the Ural Mountains, which is like the Appalachian chain. You could hike right. it without, you know, in the Middle Ages, you could hike it without a horse, is this divide. As you can see in my book, this is how the racial divide is created in America. You have this melange of people who've been mixing for hundreds of years already by the time the one-drop rule of blackness is invented in the 1850s. And it's used very cynically to divide Americans against each other, much to the detriment of the country ever since. When you really read about it, the absurdity of it just leaps off the page. I mean, the theory of the one-drop rule is based on a Charlottesville, Virginia newspaper editor who claims that he can spot a person of African descent with 31 great-great-great-grandparents of European descent and one of African descent by examining the man or woman's feet. That's Jeez. What the one-drop rule is based on.
And it's so interesting when you go into those distinctions like quadroon, octoroon, musty. I had never heard that before.
Yeah, before race becomes a sort of black or white matter here, there's a long list of gradations, which are mm-hmm. still to some degree used in Latin America based on the various mixtures. And these words, of course, strike us as sort of creepy and wrong.
Yeah.
On some level they are, but on some level any racial distinction is arbitrary. So in some ways, the story of writing this book was a story of being convinced by my sources. My sources were people who didn't think of themselves as black or white, but rather black and white. And to us today, that seems crazy, but that's because we're the crazy ones. These people were of European and African descent. They felt like being part French and part West African was no different than being half Irish and half Italian, or half Scandinavian and half mm-hmm. Jewish, like myself. And who are we really to disagree with that?
Right. Now, one of the things that interests me, we were talking about this a little earlier, is that this is not a book you would have written if you hadn't come to New Orleans. So talk a little bit about how New Orleans has worked on you as a writer.
So when I moved here, a whole bunch of books had kind of piled up on my bedside table, mostly about Birmingham in the 60s, where my father grew up. And I was like, okay, well, now I'm living in the Deep South. I need to read these. And I read them and loved them, especially Carry Me Home is famously mm-hmm. brilliant book. And then I thought, well, I don't live in Birmingham, even though I do have family there. I have a very, very tenuously related family here, more closely related in Birmingham and Atlanta. And I started to read on civil rights activism here. And I put into JSTOR, which is a social science search engine of papers.
Right.
I think my search terms were New Orleans and school desegregation. And I got, of course, you know, over 100 hits. And 99 of them were about the 1960s, and one of them was about the 1870s. And I thought, what the heck is this? And of course, I clicked on the 1870s one, which is about how the Orleans Parish School District was desegregated at the height of Reconstruction, quite successfully, before being resegregated in 1877. And I thought, well, you know, why do I not know about this? I love American history. I read a lot of American history. I definitely read in my 20s, I definitely read Eric Foner's 700-page book on Reconstruction.
Right.
I definitely read Strange Career of Jim Crow, which when I went back to it has one sentence that says, schools in the South remained segregated except for New Orleans. like, and that's all it is. It's like,
right.
Oh, like, well, we don't, well, that's New Orleans. They're weird. We don't really need to care about that. That doesn't count. And then as I read more, I saw how there was tremendous civil rights progress here and also in Charleston. And then I began to think about, well, why these two places? And it became clear that the activism there is in many ways led by antebellum free people of color mm-hmm. who openly identified as being mixed race. And then, of course, living here, the racial system is in some ways more American than the Americans at this point. It's very strict,
mm-hmm.
stricter than a city like Miami, for example. But you also, of course, have the actual descendants of all these people who are, you know, whether they want to take the 23andMe
test
or
not, yeah.
of, you know, have roots on both the European and African continents. I began to think a little more critically about race. I know a British friend of mine came to visit and we got to chatting with a Creole neighbor who's like many African American, significant subset of African Americans in the city has lighter skin than I do. I'm kind of like mm-hmm. on different ends of the brown paper bag rule, depending on which month it is. And afterwards, after we were walking away, I said to my British friend, What was that gentleman's race? And he said, Southeast Asian.
Wow.
And I was like, whoa, that is a really good guess for if you were completely ignorant of the American racial system. Like that man could be physically, could be Cambodian. Yeah, mm-hmm. that's not a bad guess of like what his physical, but no American in a million years would ever think this was anything other than a Southern black man.
Incredible story. You make the point in your very title, The Accident of Color. It is an accident. And the whole idea that we were enforcing laws based on the evidence of eyes only.
Yeah, I really tried to highlight, I kept coming up with, kept finding these amazing quotes highlighting the ambiguity of race. And I tried to keep as many of them as possible. If mm-hmm. it, you know, may feel like the reader's getting knocked over the head with them a little bit, but it's so heterodox from our perspective that I thought it was important. I mean, there's a streetcar company president here when they're trying to resegregate the streetcars who says, you know, like the greatest ethnographer in the world couldn't walk down the aisle of a streetcar in New Orleans and figure out what everyone's great grandparents' ethnicity was.
Certainly.
And it's absurd that we would even try that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also found, I think maybe to me, maybe the most exciting or fascinating part is that in the legal record, in the legal record of civil rights cases coming out of New Orleans, the last and most famous of which is Plessy, but it's a very long yeah. tradition, there's a constant harping on the sort of ineffability of race, that people are mixed and that we can't really assign unitary races to Americans, and that if we try, we'll often fail. We'll often be incorrect in our guess about somebody's deceased great-grandparents by looking at them. And over and over, I try to highlight that. And what's most interesting is in the civil rights period, in the Reconstruction period, when the laws are all Americans need to be treated equally regardless of race, color, or previous condition of servitude, it's the plaintiffs, it's the people who've been discriminated against who are raising in their cases, well, what is a white man? What is a black man? What is race? Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting because the whole point of these laws is it doesn't matter what race you are. You should win your case and be served regardless. But I think they saw that they had more hope of sort of conquering American racism if they were putting American race on trial mm-hmm. as well.
Right. So talk a little bit about the time period in which you wrote this book, which is a remarkable, convulsive period of change in our country.
Yeah, I started writing the book when Obama was president, and I finished it under Trump. I have different feelings about both periods, but both periods were useful and helpful in writing about the book. I mean, the Obama period highlighted for me how odd our racial system is to watch someone who is openly mixed race kind of wrestle with these issues in real time on television. You know, once you become a celebrity now, then they do your genealogy. And of course, I didn't get as much play as I thought it should have, but like Obama's quote unquote white mother from Kansas is descended from a African born slave. Mm-hmm. It also kind of problematized that. So the weird thing about Barack Obama is he's descended from slaves on his white mom's side, but not his black dad's side, which is a totally strange, atypical or counterintuitive situation, at least as we're raised. And then going through the Trump period, where you do, you have a candidate who's literally endorsed by the Ku Klux Klan, and then when it asked about what, you know, David Duke's endorsement, says he hasn't heard of David Duke. Mm. He doesn't know who that is. And also a way in which race is intentionally used to divide the country in a way that, you know, is reminiscent of this backlash against Reconstruction that also shaped the book. And it also just raised the stakes. I mean, the dedication of the book is for our republic. It raised the stakes of, and that was a decision I made definitely during the Trump administration, well, for our republic in the sense of dedicated to the republic out of a sense of debt to the republic, which only in a country like this is a story like mine even possible.
Right.
But also for our republic in a sense of like, this might help.
Yeah, hope.
This might help.
And you broke all the rules of writing this book, didn't you?
I broke all the rules of the cocktail party.
Oh.
You know, they say never bring up race, politics, religion, or sex. And this book is basically about race, politics, religion, and sex.
So everybody needs to read it.
So right. Can't resist that.
We've been talking with Daniel Brook, whose new book is The Accident of Color, A Story of Race and Reconstruction. You can meet him Tuesday, June 18th at 7 at Antenna Gallery at 3701 St. Claude Avenue. Daniel, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure to welcome Kelly Harris back to The Reading Life. Kelly is a poet and literary activist, and she's here today to talk about her new work as the Literary Outreach Coordinator for Poets and Writers. And if we're lucky, she'll share some poetry with us. Kelly, welcome back.
Thank you for having me, Susan. How are you today?
Great. So tell us about this new job for you. Poets and Writers has such a distinguished history, and to be part of that is very exciting.
It is. It is approaching its 50th anniversary in 2020, and they wanted to do something special to mark that 50th anniversary. And part of multiple events that they're going to be hosting is also this new initiative where they're piloting three cities across the country: Houston, Detroit, and New Orleans.
Yay.
And they thought about, you know, we've been doing this for a while. We've been funding not only these cities, but we've also funded New York, Cleveland, San Francisco. I think there are eight other cities. And they thought, you know, we are giving money, but we still have a distance from the people. And we really want to be more intentional about not just giving money, but really being connected on the ground. And so New Orleans, Houston, and Detroit are kind of the guinea pigs for, I think, maybe something that can happen larger down the line for really helping cities create literary communities.
So these programs will be funded by the Hearst Foundations?
Yes, and we're so grateful for their support of the literary arts.
So what sorts of things does Poets and Writers fund, and how do you go about searching for them?
So there's readings, there are workshops, and there are panels. And I think within that, there are some opportunities to do some out-of-the-box creative partnerships, perhaps with writers and other entities in the city, because New Orleans is so creative and booming with artists. I think there are some opportunities to place writers in places that maybe they haven't typically been. So that being said, you know, there's the typical things, the readings, as I said, the workshops and the panels. You can, you know, do that. In the past, they've funded some things that are connected to festivals. And so I encourage people to apply. And I will say that we're kind of on the bottom for applications, and we want to get those numbers up. I don't think it's because we don't have the literary programming in the city. We want to kind of demystify the idea of applying for a grant. You know, so many artists, they want the money, but they don't want to go through the hassle and the process of grant writing or applying for a grant. And it's really not as hard as it may sound or look on the website. It's really, I think, more of an application than a grant with a capital G, if you will.
So individuals can apply directly? You don't have to be a 501c3 organization?
Yeah, we encourage, first and foremost, that writers apply. We want this to be writers-led. But it isn't to say that a writer can't pair with someone else to kind of get the application done. But we want to strengthen writers to be able to advocate for themselves when it comes to grants and money, and also to be kind of the lead on the vision for what that project, reading, panel, or event could be.
Mm-hmm. So where do people go to find more information about how to fill out these grant applications?
Sure. They can go to poetsandwriters.org or pw.org. We're on Twitter at NOLAPWorg. And they can email me at NOLA@pw.org. So there's multiple ways, but if you just type in or Google Poets and Writers funding, it should pop up for you.
And there's no specific deadline. This is an ongoing thing.
No specific deadline, ongoing. So if you know that you want to do something in the fall, this would be a good time to try to get it in. I would also say we do have technical assistance out of New York. Big shout out to Bonnie and Ricardo in New York, who worked tirelessly in that department to get funding to various cities across the country. And they are more than willing to help you with kind of the real details of the process. And I'm also available as well. I'm just kind of a bridge between folks in the city and the folks in New York. And I really applaud them for thinking, you know, yeah, we have the money, but it's really important that we put the money and the opportunity in people's hands on the ground. And so they really started funding New Orleans after Katrina in 2007.
So how's your own work going? Did you bring some work to share today?
I did. You and I were talking about, I think the last time I was here, I don't know if I had a baby by then, but I do have a little girl. And I try to bring her to as many poetry readings as I can and get her involved. I should announce officially that I do have a book coming out in November with Xavier Press.
Great.
Over Uptown sort of ish, kind of ish. And so I'm looking forward to that. It's called Shame on Her, Poems and Essays. And it's really looking at the shame and trauma that is put on Black women in particular. Mm-hmm. And the book is in three sections. It's one looking at mothers and girlhood. The second session is looking at how women navigate through various parts of life. The third section is looking at prominent Black women, everybody from Anita Hill to Michelle Obama to just other folks. And then there's a few short essays in the back.
And the poem you're going to read for us right now is from that book, right?
Yes. I was thinking of Leah Chase and just how grand she was to New Orleans. And so I thought I'd bring this poem, which I wrote for Aretha Franklin, called How to Die Like a Diva. Mm. To be eternal, you've got to be extra. Stretch death out around the corner. Feed the people your life. Linger around the rim of their lips. Keep them talking over dinner. You want them to kiss your ashes. Frame your spirit on t-shirts. Advertise your bones like a miracle coming. It's got to be a grand grief, a big old goodbye, a grief so grand that no one can stop talking. The diva way, black ritual, gotta keep it real and really long and out of order and over time, CP time with no apologies. Going up yonder is sacred spectacle. It's got to be mega, mega church, mega hats, mega celebrities and old-fashioned ushers waiting for the fall and the weeping while the organ player conjures the Holy Ghost. Oh, baby, you gotta have church if you're gonna die. It's got to be planned and slightly petty. Gotta show them how to love the Lord and luxury. A diva has to die with expectations and her feet crossed, unbothered. Got to wear the devil's favorite color entering the pearly gates. Have to walk in and toss your fur and ask the angels, how do I look?
Oh, Kelly, you are the best reader. I could listen to you all day. That is fantastic.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Oh, my gosh. And then we're going to listen to a little bit of a poem that you have on your website that you perform with your daughter, Naomi.
Yes.
So tell us the story of that poem.
So I'm an avid New Orleans Library lover.
Yes.
I think it is one of the best comeback stories post-Katrina. And so we were at story time and they were singing, "If you're happy and you know it, clap your hands." And there was a little boy who kept tripping other children, and he particularly had his target on Naomi, and he kept trying to trip her. And she didn't seem bothered by it, but I was, and I approached the parent and said, "You know, your son keeps trying to trip my daughter." And she said, "Oh, he just likes tripping people." And I was like, "Huh?" And so in that moment, I thought, this is what Black people do. Black people do this kind of dance while avoiding the falls and the traps kind of laid for them. And so I thought I wanted to give her an affirmation that she could use, that she could say, that she could sing anytime, any place, whether I was there or not, that she could go to and affirm herself.
And what's the name of this poem?
It's called "I Am Black."
I am black, black, black girl. Don't feel sad, 'cause I'm living in a white world. I am black, black, black. My hair is a globe of naps, snaps, snaps. I am black, black, black. I'm happy and I know it, so get back, back, back. Left foot, now the right. Trip me once, but not twice. Twice as good, don't you see? I am 4 years old. Mama say every day I am beautiful. I am black, black, black. Got my daddy and my mama and my village too. Takes all of them to raise me, but I know what to do, do. I'm going to jump back and kiss myself. 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 Jump, jump, jump back and kiss myself. Jump, jump, jump back and kiss myself. Jump, jump, jump back and kiss myself. Jump back and kiss myself. I am
black, black, black.
It is beautiful.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Kelly Harris, who is the new literary outreach coordinator for New Orleans with Poets and Writers, and a great poet and literary activist. For more information, email nola@pw.org or go to the website pw.org. Kelly, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week here in New Orleans. The Maple Leaf Bar celebrates the 40th anniversary of the longest-running poetry reading series in the South on one of the most famous patios in New Orleans. John Travis's Portals Press issues a new anthology of work from Maple Leaf poets, and there will be a reading and signing Sunday at 3:30 at the Maple Leaf. Poet Bill Lavender joins visual artist Hannah Shalhoub at the June Unlikely Salon, Monday, June 17th, from 7 to 9 at Zeitgeist Theater and Lounge, 6621 St. Claude Avenue in Araby. Lovejoy Bodler discusses and signs Crooked Snake, The Life and Crimes of Albert Leppard, Tuesday, June 18th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Today's guest, Daniel Brook, discusses and signs The Accident of Color, A Story of Race and Reconstruction, Tuesday, June 18th at 7 at Antenna Gallery, 3701 St. Claude Avenue. Claudia Gray discusses and signs her young adult books and her Star Wars novels, Wednesday, June 19th at 5 at the Martin Luther King Library, 1611 Caffin Avenue. Slate National Editor Josh Levine discusses and signs The Queen, The Forgotten Life Behind an American Myth, an account of the life and crimes of America's original welfare queen, Linda Taylor. That's Wednesday, June 19th at 7 at the Jewish Community Center, 5342 St. Charles Avenue. Tammy L. Turner discusses and signs Dick Waterman, A Life in Blues, her new biography of the renowned manager of Sun House, Mississippi Fred McDowell, Buddy Guy, and Bonnie Raitt, and a host of other iconic blues artists. Thursday, June 20th at 6 at Octavia Books. Maurice Carlos Ruffin and James Nolan read and discuss their work Thursday, June 20th at 6 at the Alvar Library, 913 Alvar Street. Dogfish presents Sharon Renee Thomas and Brian Camp Thursday, June 20th at 7 at 2448 North Villery. Tubby and Coo's Mid-City Bookshop presents Amanda Montell, author of Word Slut, A Feminist Guide to Taking Back the English Language, Sunday, June 23rd from 1 to 3 at Reading Between the Wines at Pearl Wine Company, 3700 Orleans. Narrative 4, N4, in partnership with the New Orleans Museum of Arts Art and Letters Series, presents An Extraordinary Night of Music and Literature, Sunday, June 23rd at 6:30 at the New Orleans Museum of Art. 8 international authors will read excerpts of their work, accompanied by a musical composition created to match the piece and the author's home region. The writers include Man Booker Prize-winning author Marlon James from Jamaica, National Book Award-winning author Colin McCann from Ireland, Sierra Club John Muir awardee Terry Tempest Williams from Utah, New York Times bestselling author Ishmael Bea from Sierra Leone, former Louisiana State Poet Laureate Daryl Bourke, Irish novelist Ruth Gilligan, and Persian, Paris-based author Laila Azam Zaghaneh. PEN awardee Robert Spillman from New York will also appear. Zydeco superstar Bruce Sunpie Barnes of New Orleans will compose the musical pieces, and he will be joined on stage by Calm McCon Yomara, famed violinist from the Irish band The Frames, along with the New Orleans Brass Band and other local musicians. The event is free and open to the public, but please RSVP at education@noma.org or call 504-658-4128. Doors open at 6:30 p.m. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org. ¶¶